He had the tumbler twice, but both times the bobby pin slipped off, and the tumbler snapped back before he could do more than begin to move it. The bobby pin was starting to bend. He thought that it would break after another two or three tries. "Please, God," he said, sliding it in again. "Please, God, what do you say? Just a little break for the kid, that's all I'm asking."
"Folks, Sheldon has performed heroically today, but this has got to be his last shot. The crowd has fallen silent."
He closed his eyes, the sportscaster's voice fading as he listened avidly to the minute rattle of the pin in the lock. Now, here was resistance. The tumbler. He could see it lying in there like a curved foot of a rocking chair, pressing the tongue of the lock, holding it in place, holding him in place.
"It's strictly Mickey Mouse, Paul. Just stay cool."
When you hurt this badly, it was hard to stay cool. He grasped the doorknob with his left hand, reaching under his right arm to do it, and began to apply gentle pressure to the bobby pin. A little more. A little more. In his mind, he could see the rocker beginning to move in its dusty little alcove. He could see the lock's tongue begin to retract. No need for it to go all the way, good God, no. No need to overturn the rocking chair, to use Tom Twyford's metaphor. Just the instant it cleared the doorframe. A push. The pin was simultaneously starting to bend and slip. He felt it happening, and in desperation he pushed upward as hard as he could, turned the knob, and shoved the door. There was a snap as the pin broke in two, the part in the lock falling in, and he had a dull moment to consider his failure, before he saw that the door was slowly swinging open with the tongue of the lock sticking out of the plate like a steel finger. "Jesus," he whispered. "Jesus, thank you."
"Let's go to the videotape!"
Warner Wolf screamed exultantly in his mind, as the thousands in Annie Wilkes Stadium, not to mention the untold millions watching at home, broke into thunderous cheers. "Not now, Warner," he croaked, and began the long, draining job of backing and filling the wheelchair so he could get a straight shot at the door. He had a bad, no, not just bad, terrible, horrible moment when it seemed the wheelchair was not going to fit. It was no more than 2 inches too wide, but that was 2 inches too much. "She brought it in collapsed. That's why you thought it was a shopping cart at first," his mind informed him drearily. In the end, he was able to squeeze through, barely, by positioning himself squarely in the doorway and then leaning forward enough to grab the jambs of the door in his hands. The axle caps of the wheels squalled against the wood, but he was able to get through. After he did, he grayed out again. Her voice called him out of his daze. He opened his eyes and saw she was pointing a shotgun at him. Her eyes glittered furiously. Spit shone on her teeth.
"If you want your freedom so badly, Paul," Annie said, "I'll be happy to grant it to you."
She pulled back both hammers. He jerked, expecting the shotgun blast. But she wasn't there, of course. His mind had already recognized the dream. Not a dream. A warning. She could come back at any time. Any time at all. The quality of the light fanning through the half-open bathroom door had changed, grown brighter. It looked like noon light. He wished the clock would chime and tell him just how close to right he was, but the clock was obstinately silent. She stayed away 50 hours before. So she did. And she might stay away 80 this time. Or you might hear that Cherokee pulling in 5 seconds from now. In case you didn't know it, friend, the Weather Bureau can post tornado warnings. But when it comes to telling exactly when and where they'll touch down, you don't know fuck all. "True enough," he said, and rolled the wheelchair down to the bathroom. Looking in, he saw an austere room floored with hexagonal white tiles. A bathtub with rusty fans spreading below the faucet stood on clawed feet. Beside it was a linen closet. Across from the tub was a sink. Over the sink was a medicine cabinet. The floor bucket was in the tub. He could see its plastic top. The hall was wide enough for him to swing the chair around and face the door, but now his arms were trembling with exhaustion. He had been a puny kid, and so he had tried to take reasonably good care of himself as an adult. But his muscles were now the muscles of an invalid, and the puny kid was back, as if all that time spent doing laps and jogging and working out on the Nautilus machine had been only a dream. At least this doorway was wider. Not much, but enough to make his passage less hair-raising. Paul bumped over the lintel, and then the chair's hard rubber wheels rolled smoothly over the tiles. He smelled something sour that he automatically associated with hospitals. Lysol, maybe. There was no toilet in here, but he had already suspected that. The only flushing sounds came from upstairs, and now that he thought of it, one of those upstairs flushes always followed his use of the bedpan. Here there was only the tub, the basin, and the linen closet with its door standing open. He gazed briefly at the neat piles of blue towels and washcloths. He was familiar with both from the sponge bath she had given him, and then turned his attention to the medicine cabinet over the washstand. It was out of reach. No matter how much he strained, it was a good 9 inches above the tips of his fingers. He could see this, but reached anyway, unable to believe fate or God or whoever could be so cruel. He looked like an outfielder reaching desperately for a home run ball he had absolutely no chance of catching. Paul made a wounded, baffled noise, lowered his hand, and then leaned back, panting. The gray cloud lowered. He willed it away and looked around for something he could use to open the medicine cabinet's door, and saw an O-cedar mop leaning stiffly in the corner on a long blue pole. You going to use that? Really? Well, I guess you could. Pry open the medicine cabinet door and then just knock a bunch of stuff out into the basin. But the bottles will break. And even if there are no bottles, fat chance. Everyone has at least a bottle of Listerine or Scope or something in their medicine cabinet. You have no way of putting back what you knocked down. So when she comes back and sees the mess, what then? I'll tell her it was misery, he croaked. I'll tell her she dropped by looking for a tonic to bring her back from the dead. Then he burst into tears. But even through the tears, his eyes were conning the room, looking for something, anything. Inspiration, a break, just a fucking break. He was looking into the linen closet again, and his rapid breath suddenly stopped. His eyes widened. His first cursory glance had taken in the shelves with their stacks of folded sheets and pillowcases and washcloths and towels. Now he looked at the floor, and on the floor were a number of square cardboard cartons. Some were labeled Upjohn. Some were labeled Lily. Some were labeled Cam Pharmaceuticals. He turned the wheelchair roughly, hurting himself, not caring. Please, God, don't let it be her cache of extra shampoo or her tampons or pictures of her dear old sainted mother or... He fumbled for one of the boxes, dragged it out, and opened the flaps. No shampoo, no Avon samples. Far from it. There was a wild jumble of drugs in the carton, most of them in small boxes marked samples. At the bottom, a few pills and capsules, different colors, rolled around loose. Some, like Motrim and Lopressor, the hypertension drug his father had taken during the last 3 years of his life, he knew. Others he had never heard of. Novril, he muttered, raking wildly through the box while sweat ran down his face and his legs pounded and throbbed. Novril, where's the fucking Novril? No Novril. He pushed the flaps of the carton closed and shoved it back into the linen closet, making only a token effort to replace it in the same place it had been. Should be all right. The place looked like a goddamn junk heap. Leaning far to his left, he was able to snag a second carton. He opened it and was hardly able to credit what he was seeing. Darvon. Darvocet. Darvon Compound. Morphos and Morphos Complex. Librium. Valium. And Novril. dozens and dozens and dozens of sample boxes. Lovely boxes, dear boxes. Oh, lovely, dear, sainted boxes. He clawed one open and saw the capsules she gave him every 6 hours, enclosed in their little blisters. Not to be dispensed without physician's prescription, the box said. Oh, dear Jesus, the doctor is in, Paul sobbed. He tore the cellophane apart with his teeth and chewed up 3 of the capsules, barely aware of the bruisingly bitter taste. He halted, stared at the 5 that were left encased in their mutilated cellophane sheet, and gobbled a 4th. He looked around quickly, chin down on his breastbone, eyes crafty and frightened. Although he knew it was too soon to be feeling any relief, he did feel it. Having the pills, it seemed, was even more important than taking the pills. It was as if he had been given control of the moon and the tides, or had just reached up and taken it. It was a huge thought, awesome, and yet also frightening, with undertones of guilt and blasphemy. If she comes back now. All right, okay. I get the message. He looked into the carton, trying to calculate how many of the sample boxes he might be able to take without her realizing a little mouse named Paul Sheldon had been nibbling away at the supply. He giggled at this, a shrill, relieved sound, and he realized the medication wasn't just working on his legs. He had gotten his fix if he wanted to be perfectly vulgar about it. Get moving, idiot. You have no time to enjoy being stoned. He took 5 of the boxes, a total of 30 capsules. He had to restrain himself from taking more. He stirred the remaining boxes and bottles around, hoping the result would look no more or less helter-skelter than it had when he first peered into the box. He refolded the flaps and slipped the box back into the linen closet. A car was coming. He straightened up, eyes wide. His hands dropped to the arms of the wheelchair and gripped them with panicky tightness. If it was Annie, he was screwed, and that was the end of it. He would never be able to maneuver this balky, oversized thing back to the bedroom in time. Maybe he could whack her once with the O-Cedar mop or something, before she wrung his neck like a chicken. He sat in the wheelchair with the sample boxes of Novril in his lap and his broken leg stuck stiffly out in front of him, and waited for the car to pass or turn in. The sound swelled endlessly, then began to diminish. Okay. Do you need a more graphic warning, Paul, baby? As a matter of fact, he did not. He took a final glance at the cartons. They looked to him about as they had when he had first seen them, although he had been looking at them through a haze of pain and could not be completely sure. But he knew that the piles of boxes might not be as random as they had looked. Oh, not at all. She had the heightened awareness of the deep neurotic, and might have had the position of each box carefully memorized. She might take one casual glance in here and immediately realize in some arcane way what had happened. This knowledge did not bring fear, but a sense of resignation. He had needed the medication, and he had somehow managed to escape his room and get it. If there were consequences, punishment, he could face them with at least the understanding that he could have done nothing but what he had done. And of all she had done to him, this resignation was surely a symptom of the worst. She had turned him into a pain-racked animal with no moral options at all. He slowly backed the wheelchair across the bathroom, glancing behind himself occasionally to make sure he wasn't wandering off course. Before, such a movement would have made him scream with pain, but now the pain was disappearing under a beautiful glassiness. He rolled into the hall and then stopped as a terrible thought struck him. If the bathroom floor had been slightly damp or even a bit dirty. He stared at it, and for a moment the idea that he must have left tracks on those clean white tiles was so persuasive that he actually saw them. He shook his head and looked again. No tracks. But the door was open farther than it had been. He rolled forward, swung the wheelchair slightly to the right so he could lean over and grab the knob, and pulled the door half closed. He eyed it, then pulled it a bit closer to the jamb. There. That looked right. He was reaching for the wheels, meaning to pivot the chair so he could roll back to his room,
when he realized he was pointed more or less toward the living room. And the living room was where most people kept their telephone, and... light bursting in his mind like a flare over a foggy meadow.
Hello, Sidewinder Police Station, Officer Humbuggy speaking.
Listen to me, Officer Humbuggy. Listen very carefully and don't interrupt, because I don't know how much time I have. My name is Paul Sheldon. I'm calling you from Annie Wilkes' house. I've been a prisoner here for at least 2 weeks, maybe as long as a month. Annie Wilkes? Get out here right away. Send an ambulance. And for Christ's sake, get here before she gets back.
Before she gets back, Paul moaned.
Oh, yeah. Far out. What makes you think she even has a phone? Who have you ever heard her call? Who would she call? Her good friends, the Roydmans? Just because she doesn't have anyone to chatter with all day doesn't mean she is incapable of understanding that accidents can happen. She could fall downstairs and break an arm or a leg. The barn might catch fire. How many times have you heard this supposed telephone ring? So now there's a requirement? Your phone has to ring at least once a day or Mountain Bell comes and takes it out? Besides, I haven't even been conscious most of the time. You're pushing your luck. You're pushing your luck and you know it.
Yes, he knew it. But the thought of that telephone, the imagined sensation of the cool black plastic under his fingers, the click of the rotary dial or the single booping sound as he touched tone zero, these were seductions too great to resist. He worked the wheelchair around until it was directly facing the parlor, and then he rolled down to it. The place smelled musty, unaired, obscurely tired. Although the curtains guarding the bow windows were only half-drawn, affording a lovely view of the mountains, the room seemed too dark. Because its colors were too dark, he thought. Dark red predominated, as if someone had spilled a great deal of Venus blood in here. Over the mantel was a tinted photograph portrait of a forbidding woman with tiny eyes buried in a fleshy face. The rosebud mouth was pursed. The photograph, enclosed in a rococo frame of gold gilt, was the size of the president's photograph in the lobby of a big city post office. Paul did not need a notarized statement to tell him that this was Annie's sainted mother. He rolled farther into the room. The left side of the wheelchair struck a small occasional table covered with ceramic gewgaws. They chattered together, and one of them, a ceramic penguin sitting on a ceramic ice block, fell off the side. Without thinking, he reached out and grabbed it. The gesture was almost casual, and then reaction set in. He held the penguin tightly in his curled fist, trying to will the shakes away.
You caught it, no sweat. Besides, there's a rug on the floor, probably wouldn't have broken anyway. But if it had, his mind screamed back, if it had. Please, you have to get back to your room before you leave something. A track.
No, not yet. Not yet, no matter how frightened he was, because this had cost him too much. If there was a payoff, he was going to have it. He looked around the room, which was stuffed with heavy, graceless furniture. It should have been dominated by the bow windows and the gorgeous view of the Rockies beyond them, but was instead dominated by the picture of that fleshy woman, imprisoned in the ghastly, glaring frame, with its twists and curlicues and frozen gilded swags. On a table at the far end of the couch, where she would sit to watch TV, was a plain dialer telephone. Gently, hardly daring to breathe, he put the ceramic penguin. "Now my tale is told," the legend on the block of ice read, back on the knick-knack table and rolled across the room toward the phone. There was an occasional table in front of the sofa. He gave it a wide berth. On it was a spray of dried flowers in an ugly green vase, and the whole thing looked top-heavy, ready to tip over if he so much as brushed it. No cars coming outside, only the sound of the wind. He grasped the handset of the phone in one hand and slowly picked it up. A queer, predestinate sense of failure filled his mind,
even before he got the handset to his ear and heard the nothing. He replaced the receiver slowly, a line from an old Roger Miller song occurring to him, and seeming to make a certain senseless sense. No phone, no pool, no pets. I ain't got no cigarettes. He traced the phone cord with his eye, saw the small square module on the baseboard, saw that the jack was plugged into it. Everything looked in perfect working order. Like the barn, with its heat tapes. Keeping up appearances is very, very important. He closed his eyes and saw Annie removing the jack and squeezing Elmer's glue into the hole in the module. Saw her replacing the jack in the dead white glue, where it would harden and freeze forever. The phone company would have no idea that anything was wrong, unless someone attempted to call her and reported the line out of service. But no one called Annie, did they? She would receive regular monthly bills on her dead line, and she would pay them promptly. But the phone was only stage dressing, part of her never-ending battle to keep up appearances. Like the neat barn with its fresh red paint and cream trim and heat tapes to melt the winter ice. Had she castrated the phone in case of just such an expedition as this? Had she foreseen the possibility that he might get out of the room? He doubted it. The phone, the working phone, would have gotten on her nerves long before he came. She would have lain awake at night, looking up at the ceiling of her bedroom, listening to the high country whine of the wind, imagining the people who must be thinking of her with either dislike or outright malevolence, all the world's roidmans, people who might, any of them, at any time, take a notion to call her on the telephone and scream, "You did it, Annie. They took you all the way to Denver, and we know you did it. They don't take you all the way to Denver if you're innocent." She would have asked for and gotten an unlisted number, of course. Anyone tried for and acquitted of some major crime, and if it had been Denver, it had been major, would have done that. But even an unlisted number would not comfort a deep neurotic like Annie Wilkes for long. They were all in league against her. They could get the number if they wanted. Probably the lawyers who had been against her would be glad to pass it out to anyone who asked for it. And the people would ask, oh yes. For she would see the world as a dark place full of moving human masses like seas, a malevolent universe surrounding a single small stage upon which a single savagely bright pinspot illuminated. Only her. So best to eradicate the phone, silence it, as she would silence him if she knew he had gotten even this far. Panic burst shrilly up in his mind, telling him that he had to get out of here and back into his room, hide the pills somewhere, return to his place by the window so that when she returned she would see no difference. No difference at all. And this time he agreed with a voice. He agreed wholeheartedly. He backed carefully away from the phone, and when he gained the room's one reasonably clear area, he began the laborious job of turning the wheelchair around, careful not to bump the occasional table as he did so. He had nearly finished the turn when he heard an approaching car and knew, simply knew, it was her, returning from town. He nearly fainted, in the grip of the greatest terror he had ever known, a terror that was filled with deep and unmanning guilt. He suddenly remembered the only incident in his life that came remotely close to this one in its desperate emotional quality. He had been 12. It was summer vacation, his father working, his mother gone to spend the day in Boston with Mrs. Kasprak from across the street. He had seen a pack of her cigarettes and had lit one of them. He smoked it enthusiastically, feeling both sick and fine, feeling the way he imagined robbers must feel when they stick up banks. Halfway through the cigarette, the room filled with smoke, he had heard her opening the front door.
"Polly, it's me. I forgot my purse."
He had begun to wave madly at the smoke, knowing it would do no good, knowing he was caught, knowing he would be spanked. It would be more than a spanking this time. He remembered the dream he'd had during one of his grayouts, Annie cocking the shotgun's twin triggers and saying, "If you want your freedom so badly, Paul, I'll be happy to grant it to you." The sound of the engine began to drop as the approaching car slowed down. It was her. Paul settled hands he could barely feel on the wheels and rolled the chair toward the hallway, sparing one glance at the ceramic penguin on its block of ice. Was it in the same place it had been? He couldn't tell. He would have to hope. He rolled down the hall toward the bedroom door, gaining speed. He hoped to shoot right through, but his aim was a little off. Only a little, but the fit was so tight that a little was enough. The wheelchair thumped against the right side of the doorway and bounced back a little. "Did you chip the paint?" His mind screamed at him. "Oh, Jesus Christ, did you chip the paint? Did you leave a track?" No chip. There was a small dent, but no chip. Thank God. He backed and filled frantically, trying to navigate the fineness of the doorway's tight fit. The car motor swelled, nearing, still slowing. Now he could hear the crunch of its snow tires. Easy. Easy does it. He rolled forward, and then the hubs of the wheels stuck solid against the sides of the bedroom door. He pushed harder, knowing it wasn't going to do any good. He was stuck in the doorway like a cork in a wine bottle, unable to go either way. He gave one final heave, the muscles in his arms quivering like overturned violin strings, and the wheelchair passed through with the same low squeaking noise. The Cherokee turned into the driveway. "She'll have packages," his mind gibbered. "The typewriter paper. Maybe a few other things as well. And she'll be careful coming up the walk because of the ice. You're in here now. The worst is over. There's time, still time." He rolled farther into the room, then turned in a clumsy semicircle. As he rolled the wheelchair parallel to the open bedroom door, he heard the Cherokee's engine shut off. He leaned over, grasped the doorknob, and tried to pull the door shut. The tongue of the lock still stuck out like a stiff steel finger bumped the jam. He pushed it with a ball of his thumb. It began to move, then stopped. Stopped dead, refusing to let the door close. He stared at it stupidly for a moment, thinking of that old Navy maxim, "Whatever can go wrong will go wrong." Please God, no more. Wasn't it enough she killed the phone? He let go of the tongue. It sprang all the way out again. He pushed it in again and encountered the same obstruction. Inside the guts of the lock, he heard an odd rattling and understood. It was the part of the bobby pin which had broken off. It had fallen in some way that was keeping the lock's tongue from retracting completely. He heard the Cherokee's door open. He even heard her grunt as she got out. He heard the rattle of paper bags as she gathered up her parcels. "Come on," he whispered, and began to chivy the tongue gently back and forth. It went in perhaps a 1/16 of an inch each time and then stopped. He could hear the goddamn bobby pin rattling inside there. "Come on, come on, come on." He was crying again and unaware of it, sweat and tears mingling freely on his cheeks. He was vaguely aware that he was still in great pain despite all the dope he had swallowed, that he was going to pay a high price for this little piece of work. "Not so high as the one she'll make you pay if you can't get this goddamn door closed again, Polly." He heard her crunching cautious footsteps as she made her way up the path, the rattle of bags, and now the rattle of her house keys as she took them from her purse. "Come on, come on, come on." This time, when he pushed the tongue, there was a flat click from inside the lock, and the jut of metal slid 1/4 inch into the door. Not enough to clear the jam, but almost. "Please, come on." He began to chivy the tongue faster, diddling it, listening as she opened the kitchen door. Then, like a hideous flashback to that day when his mother had caught him smoking, Annie called cheerily,
"Paul, it's me. I've got your paper."
"Caught. I'm caught. Please, God, no, God, don't let her hurt me, God." His thumb pressed convulsively tight against the tongue of the lock, and there was a muffled snap as the bobby pin broke. The tongue slid all the way into the door. In the kitchen, he heard a zipper rasp as she opened her parka. He closed the bedroom door. The click of the latch. Did she hear that? Must have heard that. Sounded as loud as a track starter's gun. He backed the wheelchair up toward the window. He was still backing and filling as her footsteps began to come down the hallway.
I've got your paper, Paul. Are you awake?
Never. Never in time. She'll hear. He gave the guide lever a final wrench and rolled the wheelchair into place beside the window, just as her key rattled in the lock. It won't work. The bobby pin. And she'll be suspicious. But the piece of alien metal must have fallen all the way to the bottom of the lock, because her key worked perfectly. He sat in his chair, eyes half closed, hoping madly that he had gotten the chair back where it had been, or at least close enough so she wouldn't notice, hoping that she would take his sweat-drenched face and quivering body simply as reactions to missing his medication, hoping most of all that he hadn't left a track. It was as the door swung open that he looked down and saw that by looking for individual tracks with such agonized concentration, he had ignored a whole buffalo run. The boxes of Novra were still in his lap. She had two packages of paper, and she held one up in each hand, smiling.
Just what you asked for, isn't it? Triad Modern. Two reams here, and I have more in the kitchen, just in case. So you see...
She broke off, frowning, looking at him.
You're dripping with sweat. And your color is very hectic.
She paused.
What have you been doing?
And although that set the panicky little voice of his lesser self to squealing again, that he was caught, and he might as well give it up, might as well confess and hope for mercy, he managed to meet her suspicious gaze with an ironic weariness. I think you know what I've been doing, he said. I've been suffering. From the pocket of her skirt, she took a Kleenex and wiped his brow. The Kleenex came away wet. She smiled at him with that terrible bogus maternity. Has it been very bad? Yes. Yes, it has. Now can I...
I told you about making me mad. Live and learn, isn't that what they say? Well, if you live, I guess you learn.
Can I have my pills now?
In a minute, she said.
Her eyes never left his sweaty face, its waxy pallor and red rash-like blotches.
First, I want to make sure there's nothing else you want. Nothing else stupid old Annie Wilkes forgot because she doesn't know how a Mr. Smart Guy goes about writing a book. I want to make sure you don't want me to go back to town and get you a tape recorder, or maybe a special pair of writing slippers or something like that. Because if you want me to, I'll go. Your wish is my command. I won't even wait to give you your pills. I'll hop right into old Bessie again and go. So what do you say, Mr. Smart Guy? You all set?
I'm all set, he said. Annie, please.
And you won't make me mad anymore.
No, I won't make you mad anymore. Because when I get mad, I'm not really myself. She was looking down to where his hands were cupped tightly together over the sample boxes of Novra. She looked for a very long time.
Paul, she asked softly. Paul, why are you holding your hands like that?
He began to cry. It was guilt he cried from, and he hated that most of all. In addition to everything else that this monstrous woman had done to him, she had made him feel guilty as well. So he cried from guilt, but also from simple, childish weariness. He looked up at her, tears flowing down his cheeks, and played the absolute last card in his hand. I want my pills, he said. And I want the urinal. I held it all the time you were gone, Annie, but I can't hold it much longer. And I don't want to wet myself again. She smiled softly, radiantly, and pushed his tumbled hair off his brow.
You poor dear. Annie has put you through a lot, hasn't she? Too much. Mean old Annie. I'll get it right away.
He wouldn't have dared put the pills under the rug, even if he had thought he had time to do so before she came back. The packages were small, but the bulges would still be all too obvious. As he heard her go into the downstairs bathroom, he took them, reached painfully around his body, and stuffed them into the back of his underpants. Sharp cardboard corners poked into the cleft of his buttocks. She came back with a urinal, an old-fashioned tin device that looked absurdly like a blow-dryer in one hand. She had two Novril capsules and a glass of water in the other. Two more of those on top of the ones you took half an hour ago may drop you into a coma and then kill you, he thought. And then a second voice answered at once. Fine with me. He took the pills and swallowed them with water. She held out the urinal. Do you need help? I can do it, he said. She turned considerately away while he fumbled his penis into the cold tube and urinated. He happened to be looking at her when the hollow splashing sounds commenced, and he saw that she was smiling.
All done?
She asked a few moments later. Yes. He actually had needed to urinate quite badly. In all the excitement, he hadn't had time to think of such things. She took the urinal away from him and set it carefully on the floor.
Now let's get you back in bed, she said. You must be exhausted, and your legs must be singing grand opera.
He nodded, although the truth was that he could not feel anything. This medication on top of what he'd already given himself was rolling him toward unconsciousness at an alarming rate, and he was beginning to see the room through gauzy layers of gray. He held on to one thought. She was going to lift him into bed, and when she did that, she would have to be blind as well as numb not to notice that the back of his underwear happened to be stuffed with little boxes. She got him over to the side of the bed.
Just a minute longer, Paul, and you can take a snooze.
Annie, could you wait 5 minutes? He managed. She looked at him, gaze narrowing slightly.
I thought you were in a lot of pain, Buster.
I am, he said. It hurts too much. My knee, mostly, where you lost your temper. I'm not ready to be picked up. Could I have 5 minutes to... He knew what he wanted to say, but it was drifting away from him. Drifting away and into the gray. He looked at her helplessly, knowing he was going to be caught after all.
To let the medication work? She asked, and he nodded gratefully. Of course. I'll just put a few things away and come right back.
As soon as she was out of the room, he was reaching behind him, bringing out the boxes and stuffing them under the mattress one by one. The layers of gauze kept thickening, moving steadily from gray toward black.
Get them as far under as you can, he thought blindly. Make sure you do that so if she changes the bed she won't pull them out with a ground sheet. Get them as far under as you.
He shoved the last under the mattress, then leaned back and looked up at the ceiling, where the W's danced drunkenly across the plaster.
Africa, he thought. Now I must rinse, he thought. Oh, I am in so much trouble here, he thought. Tracks, he thought. Did I leave tracks? Did I?
Paul Sheldon fell unconscious. When he woke up, 14 hours had gone by, and outside it was snowing again. Two, misery. Writing does not cause misery. It is born of misery. Montaigne. Misery's Return by Paul Sheldon for Annie Wilkes. Chapter 1. Although Ian Carmichael would not have moved from Little Dunthorpe for all the jewels in the Queen's treasury, he had to admit to himself that when it rained in Cornwall, It rained harder than anywhere else in England. There was an old strip of toweling hung from a hook in the entryway, and after hanging up his dripping coat and removing his boots, he used it to towel his dark blonde hair dry. Distantly from the parlor, he could hear the rippling strains of Chopin, and he paused with a strip of towel still in his left hand, listening. The moisture running down his cheeks now was not rainwater, but tears. He remembered Geoffrey saying, "You must not cry in front of her, old man. That is the one thing you must never do." Geoffrey was right, of course. Dear old Geoffrey was rarely wrong. But sometimes, when he was alone, the nearness of misery's escape from the grim reaper came forcibly home to him, and it was nearly impossible to hold the tears back. He loved her so much. Without her, he would die. Without misery, there would simply be no life left for him, or in him. Her labor had been long and hard, but no longer and no harder than that of many other young ladies she had seen, the midwife declared. It was only after midnight, an hour after Geoffrey had ridden into the gathering storm to try and fetch the doctor, that the midwife had grown alarmed. That was when the bleeding had started. "Dear old Geoffrey." He spoke it aloud this time as he stepped into the huge and stuporously warm West Country kitchen.
"Did you speak, young sayer?"
Mrs. Ramage, the Carmichael's crotchety but lovable old housekeeper, asked him as she came in from the pantry. As usual, her mob cap was askew, and she smelled of the snuff she still firmly believed, after all these years, to be a secret vice. "Not on purpose, Mrs. Ramage," Ian said.
"By the sound of your coat trippin' out there in the entry, you nearly drowned between the sheds and the house."
"Aye, so I nearly did," Ian said, and thought, "If Geoffrey had returned with a doctor even 10 minutes later, I believe she would have died." This was a thought he tried consciously to discourage. It was both useless and gruesome. But the thought of life without misery was so terrible that it sometimes crept up on him and surprised him. Now, breaking into these gloomy meditations, there came the healthy bawl of a child, his son, awake and more than ready for his afternoon meal. Faintly he could hear the sound of Annie Wilkes, Thomas's capable nurse, as she began to soothe him and change his napkin.
"The wee bairn's in good voice today," Mrs. Ramage observed.
Ian had one moment to think again, with surpassing wonder, that he was the father of a son, and then his wife spoke from the doorway. "Hello, darling." He looked up, looked at his misery, his darling. She stood lightly poised in the doorway, her chestnut hair with its mysterious deep red glints like dying embers flowing over her shoulders in gorgeous profusion. Her complexion was still too pallid, but in her cheeks Ian could see the first signs of returning color. Her eyes were dark and deep, and the glow of the kitchen lamp sparkled in each, like small and precious diamonds lying upon the darkest jeweler's felt. "My darling," he cried, and ran to her, as he had that day in Liverpool when it seemed certain that the pirates had taken her away, as Mad Jack Wickersham had sworn they would. Mrs. Ramage suddenly remembered something she had left undone in the parlor and left them together. She went, however, with a smile on her face. Mrs. Ramage, too, had her moments when she could not help wondering what life might have been like if Geoffrey and the doctor had arrived an hour later, on that dark and stormy night 2 months ago, or if the experimental blood transfusion in which her young master had so bravely poured his own life's blood into misery's depleted veins had not worked. "Oh, girl," she told herself as she hurried down the hall, "some things dinna bear thinking of." Good advice. Advice Ian had given himself. But both had discovered that good advice was sometimes easier to give than receive. In the kitchen, Ian hugged misery tightly to him, feeling his soul live and die and then live again in the sweet smell of her warm skin. He touched the swell of her breast and felt the strong and steady beat of her heart. "If you had died, I should have died with you," he whispered. She put her arms about his neck, bringing the firmness of her breast more fully into his hand. "Hush, my darling," Misery whispered. And don't be silly. I'm here. Right here. Now kiss me. If I die, I fear it will be with desire for you.
He pressed his mouth against hers and plunged his hands deeply into the glory of her chestnut hair, and for a few moments there was nothing at all except for the two of them. Annie laid the 3 pages of typescript on the night table beside him, and he waited to see what she would say about them. He was curious, but not really nervous. He had been surprised, really, at how easy it had been to slip back into Misery's world. Her world was corny and melodramatic, but that did not change the fact that returning there had been nowhere near as distasteful as he had expected. It had been, in fact, rather comforting, like putting on an old pair of slippers. So his mouth dropped open, and he was frankly and honestly flabbergasted when she said, "It's not right." You don't like it? He could hardly believe it. How could she have liked the other Misery novels and not like this? It was so Misery-esque, it was nearly a caricature. What with motherly old Mrs. Ramage dipping snuff in the pantry, Ian and Misery pawing each other like a couple of horny kids just come home from the Friday night high school dance, and... Now she was the one who looked bewildered. "Like it? Of course I like it. It's beautiful. When Ian swept her into his arms, I cried. I couldn't help it." Her eyes actually were a bit red. "And you naming baby Thomas's nurse after me, that was very sweet." He thought, "Smart, too. At least I hope so. And by the way, Toots, the baby's name started out to be Sean, in case you're interested. I changed it because I decided that was just too fucking many N's to fill in." "Then I'm afraid I don't understand."
"No, you don't. I didn't say anything about not liking it. I said it wasn't right. It's a cheat. You'll have to change it."
Had he once thought of her as the perfect audience? Oh, boy. Have to give you credit, Paul. When you make a mistake, you go whole hog. Constant reader had just become merciless editor. Without his even being aware that it was happening, Paul's face rearranged itself into the expression of sincere concentration he always wore while listening to editors. He thought of this as his "Can I help you, lady?" expression. That was because most editors were like women who drive into service stations and tell the mechanic to fix whatever it is that's making that knocking sound under the hood or going wonk-wonk inside the dashboard, and please have it done an hour ago. A look of sincere concentration was good because it flattered them. And when editors were flattered, they would sometimes give in on some of their mad ideas. "How is it a cheat?" he asked.
"Well, Jeffrey wrote for the doctor," she said. "That's all right. That happened in Chapter 38 of Misery's Child. But the doctor never came, as you well know, because Jeffrey's horse tripped on the top rail of that rotten Mr. Cranthorpe's toll gate when Jeffrey tried to jump it. I hope that dirty bird gets his comeuppance in Misery's return, Paul, I really do. And Jeffrey broke his shoulder and some of his ribs, and lay there most of the night in the rain until the sheepherder's boy came along and found him. So the doctor never came, you see?"
"Yes." He found himself suddenly unable to take his eyes from her face. He had thought she was putting on an editor's hat, maybe even trying on a collaborator's chapeau, preparing to tell him what to write and how to write it. But that was not so. Mr. Cranthorpe, for instance... She hoped Mr. Cranthorpe would get his comeuppance, but she did not demand it. She saw the story's creative course as something outside of her hands, in spite of her obvious control of him. But something simply could not be done. Creativity or the lack of it had no bearing on these things. To do them was as foolish as issuing a proclamation revoking the law of gravity, or trying to play table tennis with a brick. She really was Constant Reader. But Constant Reader did not mean Constant Sap. She would not allow him to kill Misery, but neither would she allow him to cheat Misery back to life. "But Christ, I did kill her," he thought wearily. "What am I going to do?" "When I was a girl," she said, "they used to have chapter plays at the movies, an episode a week. The Masked Avenger, and Flash Gordon, even one about Frank Buck, the man who went to Africa to catch wild animals, and who could subdue lions and tigers just by staring at them. Do you remember the chapter plays?
I remember them, but you can't be that old, Annie. You must have seen them on TV or had an older brother or sister who told you about them. At the corners of her mouth, dimples appeared briefly in the solidity of flesh and then disappeared.
Go on with you, you fooler.
I did have an older brother, though, and we used to go to the movies every Saturday afternoon. That was in Bakersfield, California, where I grew up. And while I always used to enjoy the newsreel and the color cartoons and the feature, what I really looked forward to was the next installment of the chapter play. I'd find myself thinking about it at odd moments all week long. If a class was boring, or if I had to babysit Mrs. Kremet's four brats downstairs, I used to hate those little brats.
Annie lapsed into a moody silence, staring into the corner. She had become unplugged. It was the first time this had happened in some days, and he wondered uneasily if it meant she was slipping into the lower part of her cycle. If so, he had better batten down his hatches. At last she came out of it, as always with an expression of faint surprise, as if she had not really expected the world to still be here.
Rocket Man was my favorite. There he would be at the end of Chapter 6, Death in the Sky, unconscious while his plane went into a power drive. Or at the end of Chapter 9, Fiery Doom, he'd be tied to a chair in a burning warehouse. Sometimes it was a car with no brakes, sometimes poison gas, sometimes electricity.
Annie spoke of these things with an affection which was bizarre in its unmistakable genuineness. Cliffhangers, they call them, he ventured. She frowned at him.
I know that, Mr. Smart Guy. Gosh, sometimes I think you must believe I'm awful stupid.
I don't, Annie, really. She waved a hand at him impatiently, and he understood it would be better, today at least, not to interrupt her.
It was fun to try and think how he would get out of it. Sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't. I didn't really care as long as they played fair. The people who made the story.
She looked at him sharply, to make sure he was taking the point. Paul thought he could hardly have missed it.
Like when he was unconscious in the airplane. He woke up. There was a parachute under his seat. He put it on and jumped out of the plane, and that was fair enough.
Thousands of English comp teachers would disagree with you, my dear, Paul thought. What you're talking about is called a deus ex machina, the god from the machine. First used in Greek amphitheaters. When the playwright has got his hero into an impossible jam, this chair, decked with flowers, came down from overhead. The hero sat down in it and was drawn up out of harm's way. Even the stupidest swain could grasp the symbolism. The hero had been saved by God. But the deus ex machina, sometimes known in the technical jargon as the old parachute under the airplane seat trick, finally went out of vogue around the year 1700. Except, of course, for such arcana as the Rocket Man serials and the Nancy Drew books. I guess you missed the news, Annie. For one gruesome, never-to-be-forgotten moment, Paul thought he was going to have a laughing fit. Given her mood this morning, that would almost surely have resulted in some unpleasant and painful punishment. He raised a hand quickly to his mouth, pasting it over the smile trying to be born there, and manufactured a coughing fit. She thumped him on the back hard enough to hurt.
Better?
Yes, thanks.
Can I go on now, Paul, or were you planning to have a sneezing fit? Should I get the bucket? Do you feel as though you might have to vomit a few times?
No, Annie. Please go on. What you're saying is fascinating. She looked a little mollified. Not much, but a little.
When he found that parachute under the seat, it was fair. Maybe not all that realistic, but fair.
He thought about this, startled. Her occasional sharp insights never failed to startle him, and decided it was true. Fair and realistic might be synonyms in the best of all possible worlds, but if so, this was not that world.
But you take another episode, she said, and this is exactly what's wrong with what you wrote yesterday, Paul, so listen to me.
I'm all ears. She looked at him sharply to see if he was joking. His face, however, was pale and serious, very much the face of a conscientious student. The urge to laugh had dissipated when he realized that Annie might know everything about the Deus Ex Machina except the name.
All right, she said. This was a no-breaks chapter. The bad guys put Rocket Man, only it was Rocket Man and his secret identity, into a car that didn't have any brakes. And then they welded all the doors shut. And then they started the car rolling down this twisty-turny mountain road. I was on the edge of my seat that day, I can tell you.
She was sitting on the edge of his bed. Paul was sitting across the room in the wheelchair. It had been 5 days since his expedition into the bathroom in the parlor, and he had recuperated from that experience faster than he would ever have believed. Just not being caught, it seemed, was a marvelous restorative. She looked vaguely at the calendar where the smiling boy rode his sled through an endless February.
So there was poor old Rocket Man stuck in that car without his rocket pack or even his special helmet with the one-way eyes, trying to steer and stop the car and open the side door all at the same time. He was busier than a one-armed paper hanger, I can tell you.
Yes, Paul could suddenly see it, and in an instinctive way he understood exactly how much a scene, absurdly melodramatic as it might be, could be milked for suspense. The scenery, all of it canted at an alarming downhill angle, rushing by. Cut to the brake pedal, which sinks bonelessly to the mat with a man's foot, he saw the foot clearly, clad in a 1940s-style air-tip shoe, stomps on it. Cut to his shoulder, hitting the door. Cut to the outside reverse, showing us an irregular bead of solder where the door has been sealed shut. Stupid, sure, not a bit literary. But you could do things with it. You could speed up pulses with it. No Chivas Regal here. This was the fictional equivalent of Backwoods Popskull.
So then you saw that the road just ended at this cliff, she said. And everyone in the theater knew that if Rocket Man didn't get out of that old Hudson before it got to the cliff, he was a gone goose, oh boy. And here came the car, with Rocket Man still trying to put on the brakes or bash the door open. And then, over it went. It flew out into space, and then it went down. It hit the side of the cliff about halfway down and burst into flames. And then it went into the ocean. And then this ending message came up on the screen that said, Next week, Chapter 11, The Dragon Flies.
She sat on the edge of the bed, hands tightly clasped together, her large bosom rising and falling rapidly.
Well,
she said, not looking at him, only at the wall.
After that, I hardly saw the movie. I didn't just think about Rocket Man once in a while that next week. I thought about him all the time. How could he have gotten out of it? I couldn't even guess. Next Saturday, I was standing in front of the theater at noon, although the box office didn't open until 1:15, and the movie didn't start until 2. But Paul, what happened? Well, you'll never guess.
Paul said nothing, but he could guess. He understood how she could like what he had written and still know it was not right. Know it and say it, not with an editor's sometimes untrustworthy literary sophistication, but with constant readers' flat and uncontradictable certainty. He understood and was amazed to find he was ashamed of himself. She was right. He had written a cheat.
The new episode always started with the ending of the last one. They showed him going down the hill. They showed the cliff. They showed him banging on the car door, trying to open it. Then, just before the car got to the edge, the door banged open, and out he flew onto the road. The car went over the cliff, and all the kids in the theater were cheering because Rocket Man got out. But I wasn't cheering, Paul. I was mad. I started yelling. That isn't what happened last week. That isn't what happened last week.
Annie jumped up and began to walk rapidly back and forth in the room, her head down, her hair falling in a frizzy cowl about her face, smacking one fist steadily into her other palm, eyes blazing.
My brother tried to make me stop, and when I wouldn't, he tried to put his hand over my mouth to shut me up, and I bit it. And I went on yelling, This isn't what happened last week! Are you all too stupid to remember? Did you all get amnesia? And my brother said, "You're crazy, Annie," but I knew I wasn't. And the manager came and said if I didn't shut up, I was going to have to leave, and I said,